Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we'll be discussing in this episode originally came out on September 24th, 2008. It was not only a huge week for me, but the biggest week I've had since going through DCBS. I had both the most items and the most comics I've ever had in a shipment, with 55 comics, one trade, two magazines, a DVD, and the typical three monthly overhead items from DCBS of the bags and the boards, the weekly shipping, and previews. So, big week.
Oh, my cutbacks are starting to kick in because I only got 47 comics. You blew by me quite handily there, and I got one trade paperback, 100 bullets, which I get in trade. I got back issue magazine and two of those classic Marvel figures, Kang and Black Widow, and previews. So, I mean, it was certainly a lot of comics, but you got 8 more comics than I did, so.
Yeah. Well, I got that back issue magazine. I also got Draw, and the trade I got was the Showcase Metal Men trade. So, but yeah, there was just a lot of comics coming out, and, you know, do they really need to put out Wolverine First Class, Wolverine Origins, Wolverine Roar all in the same week? Also, when they put out X-Force, X-Men Legacy, it's like, come on, space some of these things out a little bit, guys. You know, at least we don't have all three Avengers titles this week. We only had Avengers Initiative and New Avengers, not Mighty Avengers as well, but it's like, when they have kind of everything for a given franchise hitting at once, I think that's a bad move.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And, we might mention that shift this week, the stealth cancellation of Black Panther.
Yeah, final issue of that. I think if we'd realized that, we might have even talked about the issue.
Yeah, it's just, that was the one where you get to the end of it, and it's like, oh, okay. And then you look and say, oh, well, I crossed it off my list. They'll say, I don't have any other issues of Black Panther ordered at all. This is my last one. And then I look and it's like, well, there's not another one solicited.
Yeah.
I guess it's over now.
I did the same thing. It's like, okay, there's no 42 or 43. I even checked the order forms to make sure I didn't just not order it or something. Because DC is very good about telling you when it's going to be the final issue of something. And even if they cut a series short early or something like that, they're upfront about it in their solicitations, and I respect that. And Marvel, yeah, there have been a number of titles that have just stopped with no real formal announcement in any way, shape, or form. Some of the other ones that did that were a couple of years back, the Hawkeye series and the Iron Fist series. You know, they just vanish into the ether, and it's hard to know if they just aren't soliciting that month or if they're done.
Yeah, was Black Panther doing bad in sales or anything? I mean,
give me a minute and I will pull up the latest set of numbers.
While you do that, I'll go over some news. We had talked about Dave Achard a while back at First Light. We talked with Spencer Douglas at the San Diego Con and covered that book. It's a fun book and very good art. And it has been public and available in the in Asia for quite a long time, and got a press release the other day that it's going to be available in U.S. comic shops this week. So take a look at it if you actually happen to have a comic shop that is very indie friendly. If you maybe look over in the D section, look for Dave Achard at First Light and pick it up off the rack and have a flip through it. I was really impressed with the art and the story in the first issue, so give that a look. And then also a news item that came out this week was that the San Diego Convention Center has a plan for expansion, whereas it used to be the largest, if not one, you know, one of, if not the largest convention center in the U.S. It has been a lot of other convention centers have blown by it, and it's now the 10th largest convention center, and the Comic-Con is outgrowing it. So they have plans now to add an additional 300,000 square feet of exhibit space, as well as another hotel.
Well, technically, they have a desire to add all of that. They're going to go through a year-long process to put together a plan to actually figure out where they're going to do and what they're going to do. So this is a good sign, but it's still at least a year out before they even get to where they can even consider starting to, break ground or have anything solid in place.
Right. Well, I guess it depends on what you call a plan. They're certainly not ready to pull the trigger, but the headline of the Union Tribune story is Convention Center has plan for expansion. And they've got a little picture in there that has like a little drawing of where they would put the extra thing. So, it's more than just somebody saying, maybe we should expand.
Yeah, but the same article says they're going to go through a year-long process. They've got to get the land. I mean, they're definitely moving forward. It's not just, hey, we think we ought to expand. They're actually taking some action on it. But they're also getting to the point where the people at Comic-Con had said that, if they don't see forward movement on this by, 2010, they're going to have to look elsewhere. Because, they've filled the capacity of the center. There is no more room, and they need to make more room. But the amount of land available kind of adjacent to that building is limited. But definitely good to see them doing something. I found the numbers for Black Panther. Black Panther 40 sold 33,564 units. So I would say that's fairly healthy sales. That's above the first issue for Runaways number 3. That's better than Moon Knight, Punisher, New Warriors. Let's see, what else? Squadron Supreme 2, The 12, Immortal Iron Fist, Ghost Rider, Eternals. I mean, it was not gone because of low sales.
It was very interesting when they pull the plug on a book like that, especially abruptly.
Yeah.
You kind of wonder what's up with that.
I think it may have just been they either the creators wanted to be doing something else, or they needed or wanted the creators to be working on some other project.
Which, again, why don't you announce something like that? Why don't you get up front with that? I mean, I can see when you want to like slink away into the night when something's leaving due to low sales,
Yeah.
But that wasn't the case with this one. So, you got 30-some-odd-thousand people who are going to be scratching their head. I wonder what happened to Black Panther.
Well, and particularly in this specific case where it was kind of the Skrulls are invading the country of Wakandia, they could have done the, does Wakandia go out with a bang? Do they win? Do they lose? Stay tuned for the final issue of, and really kind of hyped that up. But versus, it vanished into the night, essentially.
Yep.
Odd marketing move, or lack of marketing move.
You want to get into our weekly issues here?
Sounds good.
We picked the wrong issue of Fables to talk about.
Yeah, well, let's talk just briefly about kind of our process for picking issues. Right now, we're recording this on Saturday morning, October 4th. These are comics that came out on September 24th. But right now, we already know what we're doing for the next issue, and we're going to be picking the items for the issue after that. And all we have to go on is the cover and the solicitation stuff. And, yeah, sometimes we get to something where I think both of us really enjoy Fables as a series, but we picked this essentially sight unseen, and, yeah, this wasn't the right issue of Fables to pick.
And we try to be objective. It's not, we try to pick a book that we haven't talked about for a while. In general, we try to pick books that not everybody is talking about. We don't just talk about the hot books. That's why you don't hear us talking about Secret Invasion every single week or something on here. Fables we had never talked about before. In general, we both love the series. This is the start of there's a huge story arc that wrapped up in 75, and we thought, okay, well, they're going to start something new in issue 76. Let's talk about it. And, we hit this one.
Well, I'll be honest. I was a little surprised how much got wrapped up in 75, because I hadn't read that when we picked this issue of Fables. And when I did read it, it's like, wow, that actually finished off a lot more than I had expected. So this was very much a kind of a breather issue between major story arcs. And they had a guest artist on this, which I don't really think helped. That's interesting. They also had a guest colorist. So they had Mike Allred doing the art and Laura Allred doing the colors.
Yeah, they go together. It's just, normally I don't mind Mike Allred's art. It just was such a departure from the regular Fables art that it was quite jarring.
Yeah.
And some of the depictions in this issue, like Pinocchio, for instance, look nothing at all like, and even taking into account that it's a different artist. I mean, if he wasn't being called by name and walking next to Geppetto through the whole issue, you would have no inkling that this was Pinocchio. He is drawn nothing at all like Pinocchio has been drawn in any prior appearance of the series.
That was the part of the art I had the most issue with. Because I was able to say, okay, it's Mike Allred. He's got kind of a distinctive style. Maybe not a perfect choice for this, but not one that was the absolute worst they could have done either. I mean, there are others that if they'd put on this, it's like, okay, I can't read the issue. But, you know, so I was willing to give it a little bit of leeway there, but the whole bit with Pinocchio just looking completely different than he ever has in this book before irritated me throughout the whole thing. You know, Geppetto was close enough, everybody else was close enough, but, and really, it was a good, I mean, it was obvious who it was once you know it's Geppetto that they're talking about, who the kid is, but it's not until like 4 or 5 pages in that they name Pinocchio. So, and the whole thing is essentially Geppetto and Pinocchio kind of walking around Fabletown and adjusting to life there and how people react to them.
As you can imagine, Geppetto having been, well, I don't want to...
Unpopular. Let's say he's unpopular.
Yeah, he's unpopular. And, you know, he's going to be taking advantage of the general amnesty in Fabletown, but what he's done is fresh in a lot of people's minds. The story itself, being a kind of a fill-in issue and kind of a breather after the whole war that's been going on for a long time, was an okay story. If I was just rating it on story, you know, the story's a 4 out of 5. I liked the story. I enjoyed the story a lot. The art really dragged the issue down for me. Again, Allred doing most anything else I can enjoy when he's doing his, you know, 60s pop takes on superheroes or, you know, his, what did you do,
X-Force and X-Statics.
Yeah, and X-Statics and his Madman stuff. And there's just lots of stuff he's done, and I've enjoyed it. I don't know why this issue really just hit me the wrong way with his art, because his art's certainly not particularly different than his art ever is. It's just, it seemed to me an extremely poor match for this particular title.
I would say it was not a perfect match, but it was, I didn't have that negative a reaction to it. Again, once I got beyond the fact that, okay, Pinocchio is going to look off the entire issue, and I'm going to be thinking through the whole thing, okay, this is Mike Allred, because again, he's got such a distinctive style. Beyond that, I didn't really have any major issue with the art. Story-wise, good standalone story, but kind of doesn't really contribute to the bigger whole. And part of what I like about Fables is, again, that big picture. And I'm sure this will eventually, you know, kind of make... And I don't want to say that it'll make sense in the bigger picture, because it makes sense fine in the bigger picture right now. But it doesn't seem to heavily contribute to that aspect.
Well, they've had fill-in issues before, haven't they? I mean,
yeah.
I have read this in, until about 4 issues or 5 issues ago, I was reading this in trades.
Mm-hmm.
So the odd fill-in issue doesn't hit you between the eyes like this in a trade, because you're reading it along with, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 other issues of material.
I mean, for me, it comes down to, I would give this a 3 and say it's a good issue, but that the series overall typically rates a 4, sometimes a 5. It is a much more, I want to say, complex and sophisticated storyline in terms of some of the stuff that wrapped up with the previous issue, some of the stuff that's touched on here, was set up in the first issue of the series. And not in a, okay, if you haven't read that, you'd be lost kind of a way. Although, frankly, if you have not read Fables, start at the beginning. It is an excellent series, and that's the best way to get the full enjoyment out of it. Are there jump on points throughout the series? Yeah, sure. But I think if you do that, you're kind of robbing yourself of the experience of having read those first issues first. And this was, a fine, acceptable issue, but one that I didn't come out of it thinking, oh, wow, it really moved the bigger story along. It really contributed. It was just another comic, essentially. And typically, Fables can be so much more than that.
Yeah, well, for me, I gave it a 3 also. I would give the series as a whole a 5.
Yeah.
When we had the thread on, you know, top 10 comics, if I had to buy only 10 comics, Fables was on my top 10 list of, you know, if I was buying only 10 comic books, Fables would be one of them.
Certainly, if I was only getting one from Vertigo, it would be on there. If I was getting 10, I think I had it on my list too.
You know, so that to me gives it a 5.
Yeah, by definition.
You know, by definition, because it's in the top 10 books out of, 100 plus books. It's certainly in the top 10% of what I read. You know, this particular issue, again, mostly on the art part, didn't stand out for me. But like issue 75 that just came out, the last issue, that issue was a 5 out of 5. That was, you know, blew me away. Great issue. And, you know, it'll be back. The regular series artist will be back, and I'm sure this will be back on track in no time.
Yeah.
Like I said, if you haven't been reading Fables, you're not going to want to start with this issue anyway. If you are interested at all in Fables, go and pick up the first trade paperback. It should be in stock everywhere. This is one of the things that Vertigo keeps in stock and in print. And you're doing yourself a favor by reading Fables. It's an excellent book.
Well, I would say that, you know, any good comic store will keep the run of Fables in stock, at the very least the first couple of volumes of the trades, because it is, I think, one of the crown jewels right now for Vertigo. And I totally agree, that last issue, definite 5 out of 5. But this is another one that, kind of like Ex Machina, I think that the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts. And the sum of each part is usually really good. So, out of all the titles I read, this is one that I definitely give an unreserved recommendation on.
Yeah. Next up is Lady Daredevil, Man Without Fear. It's got Lady Bullseye across the top, part one, and I'm like, Lady Bullseye.
Yeah, the way they give that better prominence than the logo for the cover, or the title, I mean. Kind of funny.
I got the Dodson variant cover with the giant Lady Bullseye on the cover too. So
yeah, same here.
I don't know what the other cover looks like even. But this issue, Daredevil, we were talking about last night, kind of favorite Marvel comics, and Daredevil is one of my top favorite Marvel comics right now. I like it. Some people were saying they love Cap, and Cap was their favorite comic. I like Daredevil a hair better than I like Cap. But they're both by Ed Brubaker. So Ed Brubaker is, you know, one of the top writers putting stuff out at Marvel. I would probably say he's probably the top writer putting stuff out at Marvel by my taste right now. And this issue was certainly no exception. Kind of starting this new storyline, we just came off a really good storyline. But we introduce the character of Lady Bullseye here and try to figure out why she's going around killing people. Well, you can call yourself Bullseye in any way, shape, or form. You're not going to probably be a nice person. Some really interesting developments between Matt and Dakota North. And they leave off the issue with, you know, the perfect kind of uh-oh kind of moment where, you know, what's going to happen next? This is, you know, how a comic should be. It's not nonstop superhero action, although this issue has more of that than Daredevil has generally had for a while. And I'm kind of glad to see them kind of getting back to a little more of that.
I would agree with pretty much everything you said there. And there's actually one or two things you didn't mention about the issue that I really enjoyed. I mean, you talked about how it's usually not nonstop action. They actually do some good character moments. Certainly what they did with Dakota North here I found interesting. I really enjoyed the guest appearance by Iron Fist. And it was one that, again, character moment type stuff. And seeing I mean, the title is as much about Matt Murdock as Daredevil.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. That was a really nice Iron Fist moment, and they are sort of weaving kind of a street-level Marvel Heroes corner of the universe here, where you'll see Daredevil pop up in Iron Fist. You see Iron Fist pop up in Daredevil, and, you know, that kind of cross-continuity is nice. And, you know, Ed Brubaker having a hand in these different books also, I think, has something to do with it. But, no, that was a really nice moment, especially how they used him in the issue. Really was in step with the character and was very nice.
Yeah. This is one where, going before reading it, it's like, do we really need a Lady Bullseye? Coming out of it, it's like, this is a cool character. This is one I want to learn more about. So, you know, they won me over on that. The character moments, the fact that there's more to Matt Murdock than just being Daredevil or just being a lawyer or whatever, I'm really enjoying. Now, when we were talking last night about, you know, Brubaker and the whole Cap, Daredevil thing, part of it for me, I like the character and concept of Captain America a bit better than Daredevil. And certainly I think this entire run of Daredevil, all 111 issues, by and large has been some of the best Daredevil stuff we've gotten in decades. But at times it hasn't always clicked with me, and it's not a question of quality, because I think what Brubaker is doing here is as good and in some respects better than what he's doing on Cap. Yet for some reason I'm enjoying the stuff on Cap a little bit more. If you're reading one of these titles and not the other, check out the other.
Yeah, and actually for me, I can completely understand that. And I think that's probably why I like this one better, because I actually picked up Daredevil back when I was a kid a little bit earlier than I picked up Captain America as an ongoing. He was pretty much the first Marvel character I got into buying every issue of after Spider-Man. You know, my first Marvel book was Spider-Man, and then the next thing I picked up every issue of was Marvel Tales, which was more Spider-Man. And I think the third book that I started picking up every single issue of was Daredevil.
And wouldn't that have been around the time Frank Miller had gotten on?
No.
A little way before but
it was issue 86.
Okay.
It was when Daredevil was in San Francisco with the Black Widow, and it was Daredevil and the Black Widow kind of on the masthead.
But you were getting the Frank Miller ones off the rack.
Oh, yeah. When Frank Miller came along, I was buying that off the rack, and that was certainly a renaissance for Daredevil also. This has been a good character, but he had some down times.
Yeah, well, and what I got on initially was around the 220 mark, which is a little ways after Frank Miller's, you know, seminal run or whatever on the character. And it was still trying to evoke that mood, that style, but with lesser writers.
Yeah, I can understand if that's when you first came onto it, that would be different.
I mean, I see the coolness of the character. I see the potential. I see the greatness that Brubaker is doing, that Bendis was doing before him, and the amazingly smooth handoff there. To me, that was kind of that's how a transition between creative teams should be done, you know. And what's going on here is, again, great stuff. And I like the amount of characterization and time we spend learning more and getting to know Matt Murdock even better. Because, again, this guy has been around for decades. I mean, how much time do we really spend getting to know Bruce Wayne, Clark Kent, you know, some of the other characters? I mean, Scott Summers, you know, in the Marvel Universe as well. So this is one that I would give a 4 to. Certainly, I can see how it could get a 5 from somebody. But for me, and I don't know why, it falls just shy of there.
Well, I gave it a 5, so...
Like I said,
I can see.
So, if you're not reading this and you're the least bit interested either in Brubaker or Daredevil or street-level heroes or, you know, anything resembling that, give this a try.
The top panel on the last page notched it into 5 territory for me.
Ah. This is good stuff.
I'm looking forward to this arc, though. And I actually like moving Daredevil a little bit closer back to this kind of superhero-y stuff, away from the pure streets and lawyers and all that. I mean, I appreciated that kind of stuff, but we've had that for a while now. I would like to get back to him being a little more superhero-y and having kind of a super villain in Lady Bullseye to go up against will probably get us back in that direction.
Well, and again, bringing in characters like Iron Fist and a few others kind of, you know, ties him a little tighter back into the mainstream Marvel Universe. But certainly the title needs to walk a fine line there between being connected enough, it's still part of it, yet disconnected enough that Brubaker can still do all the cool stuff and not have to pause at any point for the Hulk rampaging around town or alien invasions or whatever, because that would really pull this book down.
Is this art team new to the book? Because Michael Lark was doing it.
I am not sure.
And here we got Clayman and Stefano Gaudino, or Gaudiano. And they're certainly evocative of the style that we've had in here, but it's a little sharper by my eye.
Hang on, I'm pulling up ComicBookDB to check. And again, anyone who hasn't checked out ComicBookDB, it's pretty much the go-to place for this kind of information. All right, let's see who did 110 was, yeah, Michael Lark. Good catch. Definitely new artist.
But, you know, you don't, it doesn't hit you between the eyes, right? It's not like, whoa, we have a new, like, obviously Mike Allred came onto Fables. It's a new art team. You're like, whoa, that's really different. Here, it was slightly different.
But it's the right style we're used to for the book.
It's in the same ballpark, and it's kind of moving along, and I'm looking at it. It's like, you know, this is almost Michael Lark, but especially in the facial characterizations, especially in the scene between Matt and Dakota. Very clean, very nice. I really, really enjoyed the art in this issue, too. So this was as close to an ideal Daredevil issue to me as we've seen in a while. And that doesn't take anything away from any of the Daredevil issues, because this has been ever since pretty much, I don't remember what happened. The Kevin Smith run.
I was going to say,
very good.
When Kevin Smith kicked this one off, it, to me, was the turning point.
And then Bendis came on, and then after Bendis, Brubaker. I mean, there has been a really long period of Daredevil where it's just been so top-notch.
There were a couple of issues of this volume of Daredevil that didn't work for me because of the art and stuff like that, and that was usually when they had David Mack doing stuff with Echo and a few things like that, where it was more artsy and less kind of traditional comic type stuff. But other than those couple of things, again, I'd go back to Kevin Smith did a good kickoff for this run. Bendis picked it up and ran with it like nobody's business. Did an amazing handoff to Brubaker, and that brings us to where we are today. So if you're liking the stuff, if you're not reading it, check it out. If you like it, there's, you know, potentially a 110 issues before this of the run that you'd also really enjoy. And I'm sure most of it's been traded by now, if not all of it, you know? Shall we move on to our final issue of the week?
Project Superpowers, number 6. You know, one thing I'll mention about this book is, and it's a very stylized logo, they're certainly not big into branding, because the book is called Project Superpowers. You never see a logo on it that says Project Superpowers. I mean, if you didn't read, you know, the inside of the front cover, you wouldn't even know that it was called Project Superpowers. They got like a big stylized S in kind of a oval kind of thing on the cover.
Yeah.
Most of the covers tend to be Alex Ross pinup poses of a character that have nothing whatsoever to do with the contents of the issue. And it's just interesting to me. In fact, the cover of this issue is this pinup page of the Scarab that's in the back of the issue, right?
The cover I have has American Spirit and Scarab on it.
Okay, I didn't even realize there must be multiple covers.
Oh, yeah.
The cover I've got is just the Scarab standing there on a totally white background. And if you, in the back, you know, they have those little
pages. Go to the inside back cover, and they show the different covers.
Not on mine.
Oh, on mine, on the inside back, they show the Alex Ross Chase cover, which is, again, just the Scarab standing there. They've got, in the center, the main cover, which I have. And then they have a negative art incentive cover, where they take the main cover.
Oh, the back cover. I see it now. Okay, sorry. I was looking inside the front cover. Oh, so I got the Alex Ross Chase cover.
Yeah. And again, the whole negative art one, where they take the main cover and just, you know, invert it in Photoshop. Ooh, wow.
I don't like those. I don't know who that is appealing to. Dynamite does that with Red Sonja. I think that's just one of their bags. It might be the only publisher that does that. And it's just like, and this is a good idea. Why?
Yeah, if that's not the epitome of a cash grab, I don't know what is. Because the Chase covers, I think, are cool.
Anyone who likes those, and I'd really like to understand what the appeal is. So, you know, send us an email.
Yeah, by all means, tell us. Explain it to us.
What is it that's cool about that to you? Because to me, I look at it and it's like, oh, looking at like a photographic negative.
I mean, on all of these covers, you're right. All you get is the stylized S. And on the cover you got, yeah, you get that. You get a character. That's it. So branding-wise, they could be doing better, but I mean, realistically, I think they're selling it to the people who know who Alex Ross is, who are getting it because it's Alex Ross. All they need to know is that, and they know the title already.
Yeah.
But definitely something of a barrier to new readers.
How's this doing for Dynamite?
That is a good question, because personally, I'm loving the series.
Well, you looked that
up.
Yeah, I mean,
it didn't
come out last
month.
The series is essentially... It's a new envisioning of a lot of characters who I believe are public domain characters from the 50s, from not even necessarily one single defunct comic book company, but potentially from several. I'm not a historian of the comics in the 50s to know that well enough, but some of the characters that we see in here I have seen in other places, like the Black Terror, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
the Fighting Yank. Since they are public domain characters, you can see interpretations of them in a variety of places. You know, when a company goes out of business and no one got the copyrights of the characters transferred to them and the creators have probably passed away or whatever without taking care of it, then, you know, things revert into the public domain after a certain period of time. And, you know, they're taking and re-envisioning this in a nice way. I'm liking the story, and I do think that one thing with the 50s characters is when you re-envision them like this, I'm liking these stories. But whenever I've gone back and they've kind of got me to, oh, if I like this, I wonder what the 50s version was like. You go back, every time I've gone back and looked at the 50s one, I'm like, whoa, I know why this company went out of business.
Yeah. Because it's the modern sensibilities and the revamp that's making it work, not necessarily anything to do with the original property.
Well, I also think that, like, if it was an enduring character done really well,
we'd still be reading it.
Would not have gone out of business.
You know? Yeah, that's totally.
I think something was wrong. Well, with it back in the 50s for it to have totally faded off the map and just been gone for all that period of time.
Well, the irony...
Same thing with the 12, right?
Yeah. The irony is, like you were saying, with Black Terror, the Yank, and a couple of these others, these are the same quote-unquote failures, and I think there's a strong case to actually say they were failures because, again, they went into the public domain. They didn't survive in the market. But people are going back to the same set of characters by and large, because a lot of the ones we're reading here you can read in Terra Obscura from the ABC line of comics or whatever over at Wildstorm. And, I mean, these are interesting characters in the modern retelling. But it's funny how much of an overlap there is at times. And it's like, hey, I've read about this character from this other publisher either last month, last year, 2 years ago, whatever. You'd think that there'd be a deeper well of obscure, you know, defunct characters that they could be pulling from.
Well, I mean, the characters themselves are cool, and it's been proven time and again. I mean, when Grant Morrison took Animal Man and made him a top popular character, you know, there are no bad characters. There are only bad writers.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a great writer with a great idea, you're going to get interesting stories pretty much regardless. And when you put mediocre talent even on the best characters, you're not going to get good results. It's all about the creators.
I agree, but it's funny because the sales trends tend to indicate that people follow the characters more than the creators. And you know, I agree it ought to be the other way around. And I dug up the numbers for Project Superpowers. The Zero issue, which was $1, sold 121,284 or so units. The first issue did about, well under half that, with an estimated 53,719 units. It then dropped to 41,612 units with number 2, 36,873 with number 3, 33,107 with number 4, and then the previous issue, number 5, did 30,547. So this one's probably going to be under the 30,000 mark. But it's still doing fairly well. It's the top seller for Dynamite, even above The Boys.
And, you know, that's about what Black Panther was selling. And, you know, we were calling 30,000 copies very healthy, even for a Marvel comic now.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's certainly a very credible showing for Dynamite. And this is their top book.
I think
you got Alex Ross is now, I don't know what kind of relationship he's got with Dynamite, but he's got to have some kind of, I don't know if he's a partner or, you know, what, but he's doing a lot of stuff for Dynamite.
Yeah, and you gotta think that the success of this is why they're going to do a Black Terror ongoing. What was the other one that's just starting up?
The Death-Defying Devil.
That was it, yeah. And it's
who was called Daredevil in the 50s, I believe.
Yep.
That character.
There's copyright and there's trademark, you know? So, yeah. Overall.
And that's why they call him Apostrophe Devil, if you notice.
Mm-hmm.
When you see the Death-Defying Devil, it's not the Death-Defying Devil, it's the Death-Defying Apostrophe Devil. You know, like, taking the dare part off.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I really get a kick out of every issue with Project Superpowers is the two-page spread they do at the end that's just a bunch of the characters. Because it's fun to see kind of, again, that 50s-ish design sense coming into play. And there's usually one or two that it's like, hey, I've read, you know, stuff with these characters from some other publisher. Like Manowar had something come out from Malibu 15 years ago or what have you. So it's a cool universe. I think they're doing some fun stuff with it. Is it highly unique and original? Well, obviously not. They're using public domain characters. Yet what they're doing with these characters, I think, is a lot of fun. And it's so different than the 12 that you were mentioning, because with the 12, they took a dozen characters, did the whole Captain America, hey, they're out for a bit, they come back. But it's a character story about how those specific personalities adjust to life in a world that's moved on to 60 years later. Here, the characters were also kind of out of pocket into a limbo-type thing for a while. It's been the equivalent 60 years, but it's not really so much a character piece about how they adapt so much as, hey, there's fighting to be done, we're heroes, let's go do it. And it's more of a more typical action type storyline.
It is action, you know, kind of breakneck action from pretty much start to finish of each issue so far, and I'm very interested. And they tend to focus in on a character or two in each issue. I do wish that they handled the branding of the comic book a little better, and, you know, made it much more apparent on the rack that it is an action-oriented team book with all these cool characters. I almost think that, you know, when you look at the cover of each issue, they typically have, you know, the S, and, you know, this issue, it says on the normal cover, featuring the American Spirit and the Scarab. And, you know, certainly, yes, it is featuring the American Spirit and the Scarab, but it's this team that is throughout the issue, and there's a lot more than that. And I almost get the feeling like the casual person who sees this on the stand, who's not of the 30,000 who are buying it, might look at it and say, oh, well, this is a comic featuring the American Spirit and the Scarab, and I don't appear to care about either of them, so I'm not going to buy it. And, you know, the last issue was, I don't remember, it was, you know, featuring the Black Terror and the Green Llama or something. And,
but you're,
you know,
right.
Same thing.
It gives the impression that you're likely to get two, you know, half-length stories of this, one for the American Spirit, one for the Scarab, versus what we actually get. So it does kind of set different expectations, and I would say pretty much the wrong ones. You're right. I hadn't thought about
now,
that.
On the back cover, where it says next month, you know, chapter one concludes, and it's looks to be like a big team kind of image that Alex Ross does, you know, a good job on. You got all these heroes coming at it. I mean, this is the kind of cover that, you know, having that on an ongoing part of the series, just kind of showing the team doing whatever the team's doing, you know, at least multiple figures from the team might have been a little better, but.
No, I think that's a very valid point. I agree with you entirely there. I mean, this to me is a more striking cover and more, oh, wow, there's a bunch of cool characters. And if you're remotely interested in any of them, it's like, hey, you know, I recognize the Green Llama or whoever. It's going to pull you in. I think that their cover strategy is less than ideal, and I think you bring up some very, very good points that they should consider when they do the second chapter of this.
But, you know, Dynamite in general, they're one of the top offenders in the variant cover, proliferation of variant covers. You rarely get a comic from Dynamite that doesn't have at least three different covers kicking around for it. The Boys might be the one notable exception. They usually have one cover, and sometimes they'll stray into a second Chase cover or something, but certainly Project Superpowers, Red Sonja, Lone Ranger, Battlestar Galactica, Highlander, you know, almost any book I can think of that comes out from Dynamite, there are so many covers.
Yeah.
That getting to the point of talking about having a cover with kind of a unified message that's going to be selling that cover becomes kind of moot when it's only going to be one cover out of three or four anyway.
Yeah, yeah. At the very least, though, they could put the full Project Superpower logo, if they have one, on all of those covers.
But, you know, that gets back to an interesting point, at least interesting to me. We'll see if it's interesting to anybody else. But, you know, back, I don't want to say it, but I'm going to say it, the olden days, you know, you know, even into the 80s and 90s, you had a cover that, and even you go back all the way to the 60s, and there was a whole job that the editor had. You know, you look at some of the classic editors of comics, you know, whether it was like, you know, Stan Lee and John Romita as art director at Marvel, or Julie Schwartz, or those guys. I mean, they came up with a cover concept that would grab you on the stand and make you say, man, hey, kid, you got to buy this comic because just – look at the crap that's going on this cover, and you got to find out what's behind this, you know? And they would just work that cover concept and that design and pull the reader into that book.
Oh, I agree with you entirely in stuff that the nature of cover designs, the marketing aspect of them is not being considered as much as it used to be. And personally, I find that very interesting because I think if you were to do an in-depth analysis both of the covers themselves, the way the comics were put in, say, previews for the last 10 years, I think and do an in-depth, you know, analysis of, okay, this is on the right page, this has a cover that's relevant to the story, this is a generic, you know, action pose that's got nothing to do with it, whatever, and tie that into how they sold, things like that, that potentially there are a lot of correlations there that could be found that would not be the least bit immediately obvious.
And it gets back to what you said, that more people seem to follow the characters than follow the stories. It's because you used to highlight the story on the cover that was being told.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had the characters in it. Now, it's almost every issue has a cover that's a poster of the character.
Yeah.
It's something that, okay, it can be sold on the secondary market by the artist as a piece of art that someone can put up as a static image of some character for the most part. And same thing when you have variant covers, and there are so many variant covers. You can't really have variant covers that are all telling you elements of the story. They're just all generic poses of it, you know. And you look at things that do get kind of accolades for artistic design on covers, and you look at James Jean's Fables covers, since we're talking about Fables this week.
Mm-hmm.
Fables covers typically do not, you know, they're very stylized and everything, but if you look at this one, it's not just a big action pose. I mean, it's telling, you know, an element of the story from the issue.
Yeah, but based on that cover, I would have, had I realized that was Pinocchio on the cover there, I would have expected it's his adventures in the big city by himself.
Yeah.
You know, does it really accurately sell the comic or not? Certainly it does so better than just a generic cover of you know, random fables or what have you.
But in general, I wish they'd get back to having a cover per issue. And maybe it's a trade-off, right? It's how many extra sales is a publisher getting because there are people out there who buy multiple covers of an issue. And, you know, so they're selling more copies because people are buying two or three instead of just one. So you're milking that same one person for more dollars. But that can work against you too, ultimately. When you have that happen on occasion, I can see if you're a completist, you know, you'll buy the different covers. But when it's every single issue, issue in and issue out, where does that get old? And, you know, well, and Dynamite, it took 20 issues. I bought every cover of Red Sonja for 20 issues. And then it's like, oh, God, I am so sick to death of hunting down and buying three or four covers of every issue. Give me a break, Dynamite. And I stopped buying Red Sonja altogether from Dynamite.
Yeah.
So I threw my hands up and said, I'm sick of it. You guys, you know, stop.
Well, I think we're at a point where it is, you know, an epidemic, because we've got publishers like Dynamite, like Avatar, that are slapping alternate covers on everything. And, I mean, you look at both Marvel and DC, a lot of titles at DC are having those other covers, you know, Final Crisis, that kind of stuff. And then over at Marvel, you have theme month of, okay, or, you know, periods, because you're right, it's not just a month. We talked about that a little last night, but the apes, the villain covers, the zombie covers, the whatever other, you know, theme cover they put on everything.
We're theorizing pirates will be next.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I don't see why not, you know? It's ridiculous. There's too much of this. And I think it's propping up sales in the wrong way. And I'd rather, particularly with something like Project Superpower, that instead of propping up sales by having the negative variant, you know, image cover or whatever, maybe if they spent a little more time on the marketing aspects of the cover and made it more useful for selling the actual contents of the comics, they would get more readers and not more buyers of the comic. And or I guess what I'm trying to say is I think they'd be better off if three different people bought a copy of this that had the same cover than one person buying three copies because they have three different covers. But, I mean, we could do a whole roundtable discussion on cover designs, pros, cons, what people expect out of a cover, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I think you get right down to it. The variant covers, when we look back upon this period of time, this is going to be the defining aspect of this period of comics history. Just like, you know, when you had the plethora of gold foil covers and stuff, you know, that funded a speculator boom in the 90s.
Yeah.
Now it's just all the variant, real variant covers. And it's, I guess, you know, if you're going to have variant covers, maybe it's a little nicer to have a completely different cover art image than just having the exact same cover with some gold foil accents on the logo. You're at least getting a different image for the separate price that you pay. So it's at least an evolution in that respect, but it's really no different than the gold and platinum covers that they had in the 90s, in theory.
Well, overall, covers aside and all that, I am enjoying Project Superpowers. I thought this was a strong issue, not the best of the run, but it's got me interested and hooked. I would give this a 4, although I could see either a 3 or a 5 fairly easily. I think that probably out of the run, this may have been the weakest issue, but still one I really enjoyed.
I'm at a 4 on this one also. It's a good, solid book. It's, you know, it's actually a great book. I'm really surprised at how good a job Jim Krueger is doing at telling the story with these characters. He took a bunch of characters I had never heard of before and is keeping the story moving along, and I'm interested and care about what's going on.
Yeah,
so,
he's,
you know,
doing
well
a,
done.
A good job making us care about the characters and juggling a huge cast without it feeling overwhelming. So definitely worth checking out. And if you like it, Terra Obscura from DC Wildstorm is worth checking out. The 12 is worth checking out. Although, again, very different type of story for the 12. Again, more character-based, less action by a long shot. But there are a number of other places where they're taking older characters and bringing them back. And we did a roundtable discussion with Chris Marshall a while back on Golden Age revival type stuff, which if you haven't listened to that episode, probably worth listening to find out more. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Vixen, Return of the Lion, number 1 from DC, Eternals, number 5 from Marvel, and Zombies of Mass Destruction, number 2 from Red 5 Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.